Chapter 9. Taming the Rogue Nation. For nearly a decade, America has been fighting a war on terrorism, aimed at rooting out terrorist networks and undermining the rogue states that support terrorism. President Obama has called an end to this war on terror. Indeed, he has instructed his leading cabinet officials not to use the term, but to speak instead of police action against criminals. Even as he attempts to wind down America's war on terrorist networks and rogue states, Obama is fighting his own war. Perhaps more precisely, I should say that he is fighting his father's war. Barack Obama Sr. didn't write about foreign policy. He was, after all, an economist. Even so, he espoused a broad anti-colonial perspective that viewed the West, and specifically America, as the invader, occupier, and terrorizer of the world. In line with the senior Obama's thinking, President Obama is conducting a war against what he considers to be the biggest rogue state of all, the United States of America. I am not suggesting that Obama is anti-American. On the contrary, he seeks a radical change in America's policies because he considers those policies bad for America and bad for the world. America is, in Obama's view, the last of the neocolonial powers. Obama sees America as having invaded and occupied two sovereign nations, Iraq and Afghanistan. Now America is, in effect, ruling those nations in much the same way that the British and the French ruled their colonies either directly or through surrogates. For Obama, America is a kind of rogue elephant, and Obama views his anti-colonial mission as one of taming the elephant. Once you understand this about Obama, all his foreign policy actions become coherent and intelligible. It may seem odd to hear America described as a colonial or imperial power. After all, the United States was itself once a colony of Great Britain. After World War II, the United States used its influence to compel Britain and France to grant independence to many of their colonies, giving America an anti-colonial reputation. Even now, Americans don't think of themselves as colonialists. On the contrary, we see ourselves as champions of self-government and liberty. But anti-colonial writers point out that the white man settled America by displacing the native Indians and taking their land. The United States forcibly took large tracts of land from Mexico and annexed Hawaii. America also occupied the Philippines from 1899 to 1946, perhaps the closest thing to direct colonialism by the United States, and America still possesses other colonial spoils like Puerto Rico, Guam, and American Samoa. After World War II, America became the heir to European supremacy. The baton of Western leadership passed from Europe to America. In the audacity of hope, Obama faults America for its role in supporting the repressive Suharto regime in Indonesia. Suharto's army targeted not just guerrillas but civilians for swift retribution, murder, rape, villages set afire. And throughout the 70s and 80s, all this was done with the knowledge, if not outright approval, of U.S. administrations. Still, that was the era of the Cold War, and the Soviet Union provided a rival and a balance to America's global engagements. Once the Cold War ended, however, America became the world's sole superpower, a top dog without a rival, what one French minister termed a hyperpower. This power became evident after 9/11. President George W. Bush issued a new national security strategy that explicitly stated that America would seek global and unchallenged military dominance. This wasn't mere rhetoric. During this period, America responded to the 9/11 attacks by invading two countries, Afghanistan and Iraq. One of these countries, Iraq, seemed to have nothing to do with 9/11. America didn't get in and get out. It is still calling the shots in both countries, if not directly, then through its local allies. This is precisely what the British and the French did in parts of Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Deepak Lal writes in a book on empire, "The United States, since the Second World War, has at first surreptitiously, and since 9/11 more openly, taken on the imperial role. Obama's teacher, Edward Said, concurred. Much of the rhetoric of the New World Order promulgated by the American government since the end of the Cold War, with its redolent self-congratulation, its unconcealed triumphalism, its grave proclamations of responsibility, all too easily produces an illusion of benevolence when deployed in an imperial setting. It is a rhetoric whose most damning characteristic is that it has been used before, not just by Spain and Portugal, but with deafeningly repetitive frequency by the British, the French, the Belgians, the Japanese, the Russians, and now the Americans. And this is the way Obama sees it. In The Audacity of Hope, Obama writes, "Roosevelt's version of the Monroe Doctrine, the notion that we could preemptively remove governments not to our liking, was now the Bush Doctrine, only extended beyond the Western Hemisphere to span the globe. Manifest destiny was back in fashion. All that was needed, according to Bush, was American firepower, American resolve, and a coalition of the willing." If America's current president sees America this way, he is joined in this respect by many of America's adversaries. Venezuela's strongman, Hugo Chavez, for example, employs a rhetoric that is militantly anti-colonial and hostile to American foreign policy. Similar strains are occasionally heard from Russia, Zimbabwe, and North Korea. Radical Islam takes a similar view of the United States. A generation ago, the Egyptian writer Said Qutb, who has become the leading intellectual guru of Islamic radicalism, wrote of Islam as the only force resisting first European and then American colonialism. "The spirit of Islam is like a rock blocking the spread of imperialism." Today, the influential Muslim cleric Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who broadcasts frequently on Al Jazeera, routinely calls on Muslims to fight against American occupation. In his videotapes and messages over the years, Osama bin Laden accuses America of leading a Judeo-Crusader alliance to massacre Muslims and dispossess them of their land and oil wealth. Bin Laden has said that terrorism is merely the Muslim defense against the blatant imperial arrogance of America, a nation seeking to occupy our countries, steal our resources, and install collaborators to rule us. Obama clearly has no sympathy for bin Laden and his radical cohorts, whom he views as gangsters and criminals. Even so, he appears to agree with their assessment that America is the neocolonial aggressor and that the best way to promote peace and security in the world is to curb America's power and influence. Jonathan Alter reports in Newsweek that one of Obama's first objectives upon taking office was to reduce the size and resources of the U.S. armed forces. Alter quotes Obama saying, "For the past 8 years, whatever the military asked for, they got. My job was to slow things down." Writing in the influential journal Foreign Policy, Walter Russell Mead notes that Obama seeks to create conditions that would allow him to dismantle some of the national security state inherited from the Cold War and given new life and vigor after 9/11. But Obama must be supremely careful in how he carries this out. He cannot announce to his fellow Americans that he intends to scale down the nation's defenses and reduce his country's influence in the world. Even many of his supporters believe they elected him to boost our national security and enhance, or at least preserve, America's leadership. So Obama's challenge is to achieve as many of his anti-colonial objectives as are politically feasible. Moreover, he must always camouflage his overall aim and take specific actions that can be defended in more conventional terms. One of Obama's first actions in the Oval Office was to repeal Bush's national security doctrine. His rationale seemed reasonable at the time. "The burden of this century cannot fall on our soldiers alone." Many Americans were pleased that Obama should solicit foreign support for America's objectives, especially from our longtime allies in Europe. Why do things by ourselves when we can find others to join us? Yes, this sounds like a great idea. But when we look more closely, we see that Obama is up to something quite different. A few months into his presidency, Obama embarked on a kind of world tour. Visiting London in early 2009, Obama told his English audience he had come to listen, not to lecture. In Germany, he confessed, "I don't come bearing grand designs. Rather, I'm here to share ideas and to jointly help shape our vision for the future." The Europeans got the message. Obama was on an apology tour, repenting for the sins of the Bush administration. The real message of his sharing was that without European approval, there would be no more U.S. invasions, no more unilateral American military action. In a way, Obama was paying the former colonial powers the compliment of using them as a restraint on American power. Barely able to contain its excitement, the Norwegian parliament promptly conferred on Obama the Nobel Peace Prize. Not that he had done anything to deserve it. The honor was basically for endorsing the Norwegian view of America's role in the world. Next, Obama carried his self-abasement routine from the colonizers to the colonized, from Europe to the more hostile regions of the world. At a meeting of South American nations on April 17, 2009, Obama told the leaders of Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, and Haiti, "I pledge to you that we seek an equal partnership. There is no senior partner and no junior partner. The United States will be willing to acknowledge past errors where those errors have been made." How nice for this motley third world crew to discover that henceforth they would be operating on an equal plane with the United States. Warming to Obama's promise to acknowledge American misdeeds, Hugo Chavez presented Obama with a copy of Eduardo Galeano's The Open Veins of Latin America. The book's theme is conveyed by its subtitle, Five Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent. The continent, of course, is South America, and guess who is doing the pillaging? Too bad the book was in Spanish, a language Obama doesn't read, because its anti-colonial themes would have thoroughly resonated with him. Chavez may have addressed Obama in the wrong medium, but he was entirely on target in his message. Visiting China in November 2009, Obama did not hesitate to criticize the Chinese government for its violation of human rights. But this criticism was carefully balanced by his lamentations for America's own human rights record. Obama noted that while China was responsible for forced abortions and the coerced trafficking in women for prostitution, we are not perfect. If you talk to women in America, they will tell you that there are still men who have a lot of old-fashioned ideals about the role of women in society. Obama struck a similar note of moral equivalence in Turkey, where his criticism of the Turkish genocide of Armenians was qualified by his acknowledgement of America's own sins, such as its treatment of Native Americans. Some conservatives chastised Obama, pointing out the indignity of an American president giving such short shrift to his own country. These critics also noted the absurdity of Obama's comparisons between America's past misdeeds and the ongoing and vastly more serious abuses by the nations the president was addressing. This criticism became even louder when Obama canceled the deployment of anti-missile defenses to Poland and the Czech Republic. Many of the right faulted Obama for his inability to distinguish between America's friends and America's enemies. Summing up these arguments, Victor Davis Hanson argued in a recent broadside that when you treat your enemies well and your friends badly, it seems that you have lost your compass. But these criticisms, in a way, miss the point. Not because they are wrong, but because they are not strong enough. Obama is too intelligent a man to intend his "you do sex slavery, but we have husbands who won't do the dishes" analogies seriously. His larger point was to telegraph to the world that he intended to be a different kind of president, one whose main focus would not be on controlling the destiny of other nations, but rather on controlling the actions of his own country. Rather than American foreign policy seeking to regulate the world, Obama was soliciting the world to help regulate American foreign policy. In other words, Obama hasn't lost his compass, as the critics allege. He seems to be operating with a different compass. Consider Obama's decision to deny Poland and the Czech Republic missile defense technology. The ostensible purpose of this was to appease Russia, and the goal of appeasing Russia was to win Russian cooperation on sanctions against Iran. If this was the goal, it manifestly failed. The Russians, just like the Chinese, have been dawdling on sanctions since the idea was first proposed. Neither country believes it is in its interest to impose severe sanctions on Iran because both have valuable commercial contracts there. The Chinese continue to buy Iranian oil. The Russians sell military technology to Iran. Every time the Russians signal, however tentatively, that they will consider sanctions, the White House is ecstatic. But somehow the Russians never come through in supporting strong sanctions, the only kind of sanctions that have a chance to make an impact. Actually, it's doubtful that any kind of sanctions would work. They haven't worked in restricting nuclear weapons anywhere else. For instance, military analyst Graham Allison points out in Foreign Affairs that America has had sanctions against North Korea for decades, and the North Koreans have gone ahead and built 10 nuclear bombs. The reason sanctions are a long shot with Iran is simple. The mullahs really want to build a nuclear bomb. If you and I were mullahs, we'd want to build a bomb. The Iranian regime has two good reasons to acquire nuclear weapons.